The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Susan Dellinger from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Oprah Magazine, February 2018, Volume 20, Number 2. And this is the fourth and final installment of the February issue. On this month's cover, Oprah channels Diana Ross. Her naturally curly, massive mane is swept back and up and to one side as if by the wind. Against a gold background, Oprah wears a shimmery gold crushed velvet long dress with a deeply scooped neckline and three-quarter length sleeves. The big white O for Oprah Magazine sits on a deep gold, almost kind of brassy background, and this month's headline is, What Defines You? It's not your hair, your job, or even the way you vote. Get ready to embrace the essential you. And we'll start off this fourth installment with advice from Martha Beck. There's been a little reorganization to the magazine, and we don't have the May We Help You section any longer. But Martha has been moved to the Live Your Best Life section. And this is part two of four, and the article is called The Nature of the Beast. O's life coach, Martha Beck, guides her new client on a search for meaning and leads her where the wild things are. And we have a picture of her client here, Dixie, in her New York apartment. And it's a very eclectic room. We have a blue and pink and cream colored Aubusson rug, but she's sitting in a black chair with a big floral print that's more kind of a 1950s vibe. Beside her is a statue of a tiger. On the other side of her, there's a statue of a zebra. There's artwork on the walls, a leopard print covered chair behind her, and lots of candlesticks and other ornaments. Dixie says, I decorated the apartment like a little girl's idea of fancy. So let's hear a summary of the first installment from last month, the backstory. Dixie Late, 55, is in a slump. Laid off in 2015 from her job as an editorial director for a TV network, she's currently a self-employed writer and brand consultant. But now that she has flexible hours, she's spending a lot of time on the couch. Her energy is low, her spirits are lower, and despite reading hundreds of motivational books, she just can't shed her existential malaise or the 40 pounds she's gained. Fortunately, O's life coach, Martha Beck, is here to help Dixie locate her missing purpose. First, Martha advised her new client to quiet her racing mind and pay attention to her physical sensations. Though Dixie's not a fan of meditation, she gamely agreed to take some deep breaths as Martha led her to focus intently on one part of her body at a time. Let's join their exercise in progress. And this is the interview. And Martha Beck says, I want you to be very aware of each area as we get to it. Try twitching the muscles in your thighs. How does that feel? These deep breaths are toggling your nervous system from the anxious fight or flight mode to rest and relaxation. We want to get to a place of stillness so we can check in with your body, which is even more key to awareness than your brain. It's estimated that the body sends the brain about 11 million bits of information per second, but the conscious mind can process only about 40 bits. Dixie's reply, which part is unhappy about the fact that my thighs are touching? Martha, you're joking, but it's a good point. Is the sensation of your thighs touching physically painful? Dixie, if I take thinking out of it, I guess not. Martha, that's because you're aware of your body, but you aren't judging it. Being unhappy about your thighs touching is a culturally conditioned judgment. There's nothing inherently wrong with having thighs that touch. It's no more wrong than having feet that touch the floor. But right now, just focus on your physical feelings. Go into your gut. Can you feel your digestive organs sitting in your pelvis? Dixie, to be honest, no. Martha, keep breathing deeply. Feel your gut expanding and contracting. You don't need to be afraid of your gut. It has a cluster of nerve cells that sends messages to the brain. Research shows that gut flora may play a role in depression and even schizophrenia. Dixie, that's interesting because in the last few years I've developed stomach problems. Martha, your gut's trying to talk to you and you can't hear it, so it needs to hurt to get your attention. To find out what to do with your life, you have to feel yourself. Neuroscience has shown us that decision-making is more about feeling than thinking. People who have damaged the emotional center of their brain can't make decisions, but people who have cognitive damage can still manage it. I know being connected with your gut and heart can be frightening. When you notice any anxiety, heat, tension, tingling, imagine that you're trying to calm an animal. Do you have pets? Dixie, 2 dogs and 4 parrots. Martha, imagine a crocodile got into your apartment. He's been taken away, but now your animals are freaking out. How would you comfort them? Dixie, I'd use a low voice. I'd say, shh, I'm not going to let anything bad happen to you. Martha, can you say the same thing to the inside of your torso where your gut and heart are? Dixie, I'll try that. The animal analogy is helpful. I'm very bad at being compassionate with myself, but not with my pets. Martha, I know it sounds weird, the idea that your gut will lead you to your purpose, but I promise if you can get still and pay attention to your body, you will feel physically pulled toward what's right for you. Have you ever played that game, you're getting warmer, you're getting colder? When I take people on retreats to Africa, they have to track a rhinoceros. If they lose the track, they usually think about where he logically should have gone and head in that direction. They can't find him because he was never there, but they keep stomping around and looking in the same spot. To track an animal, you have to search for the smallest signs of life and follow each one to the next, asking, am I getting warmer? It's the same with tracking your life's purpose. You follow the hot tracks, looking for things that spark a feeling of joy and relaxation in the body. Is there anything you could do today that would make you feel joyful and relaxed? Dixie, I don't know. Martha, what did you like to do as a kid? Dixie, I used to write my own newspaper. Martha, so you like funny, smart writing. What if you had a really funny, smart book to read today? I'll tell you the moment that started my entire career as a writer. I'd been extremely ill, and I was mentally spent. I was in doctoral training, reading about 6,000 pages a week. I finally went to a therapist who said, "When's the last time you read for fun?" And I said, "Childhood?" She told me that my assignment was to read a fun book, so I bought a copy of Jurassic Park. I stayed up reading it into the wee hours, and the next morning I got up and I thought, I want to write books that people read for fun. That spelled the end of my academic career. Dixie, even though I'm in the doldrums, I do find joy sometimes. I love reading British fashion magazines and blogs about street style, especially by women of a certain age who dress the way I do. Martha, now we're getting somewhere. You've been lost for a while, so at first your hot tracks will be strange little things. Dixie, I like talking to groups. I remember that from teaching elementary school. Martha, do you notice the shift in your energy? You sound lighter and friskier. That's your body and psyche drawing you toward things that bring you joy. So you love clothes, writing and communicating, blogs. You could put together killer outfits and create a blog about them. Dixie, I've thought about it, but I don't want to take pictures of myself. I didn't even want a lot of wedding photos. We did a guys and dolls theme and just had a mugshot photo booth. Martha, you have to keep tracking your purpose, even if it goes to a scary place. What if you just wrote, "This is weird because I hate my body right now, but I love style, and I know there are plenty of people like me, so join me." But we're getting ahead of ourselves. I don't know whether you should write a blog or anything else. Only you know that. I'm going to give you a homework assignment. Enjoy everything you do. If it brings you joy, do it. If it doesn't bring you joy, don't do it. That's not permission. It's a prescription. Dixie, is that my only homework? Martha, that's your only homework, and it lasts forever. Well, let's talk again in a few weeks. There are three snapshots of Dixie here with this article. One of them is the mugshot of she and her husband Jeff at their wedding in 2009, and he's in his black tuxedo, and she's in her wedding dress, and they're standing behind one of those little boards they put in front of someone when they're taking their mugshot, and it even says New York Department of Corrections underneath it. Then there's a picture of Dixie at age 9 on the back of a horse in a cowgirl outfit. She's got a bright pink western shirt and some really bright pink and purple and white blue jeans, I guess, and a cowboy hat. And then there's a top picture of her taken about the same time of her wedding, and she's got red hair with short bangs, and it's pulled back kind of in a ponytail near the top of the back of her head. She's standing in front of palm fronds, and she has parrots standing on her shoulders, and she's holding one in her hands. So it says, Dixie meets some parrots in Florida, her home state. And now let's move to the back of the magazine, to the Let's Eat section. And we have muffins cooling on a wire rack, a big picture of muffins, and it says, top of the morning. In her new cookbook, Food for Life, former boxer Layla Ali meets her batch with a luscious muffin that'll power you all morning long. And from Layla, confession, I've always had a sweet tooth. I can devour 4 cupcakes in one sitting. When I became an athlete, though, I started to see food as fuel that gave me the nutrients I needed to perform at my best, which meant cutting out most processed ingredients, sugars, and anything else that didn't benefit my body. Although I no longer compete in the boxing ring, I've continued to view my diet as a bridge to vitality. So what's a dessert-devoted girl to do? Make healthier treats, of course. These sweet and spiced muffins are moist and hearty and give a delicious jump start to your day. Maca, carrot, and cinnamon muffins. And here are the instructions. Preheat oven to 350 degrees. Line 10 cups of a 12-cup muffin pan with paper liners or grease with cooking spray. Sift 1 cup gluten-free flour blend, 2 teaspoons of maca powder, 1 teaspoon of ground cinnamon, 1/2 teaspoon of ground ginger, 1/4 teaspoon of ground allspice, 3/4 teaspoon of baking powder, 1/4 teaspoon of baking soda, and 1/4 teaspoon of sea salt into a medium bowl. In a separate medium bowl, whisk 2 large eggs at room temperature. Then gradually pour in 9 tablespoons of melted and still warm unsalted butter and whisk to combine. Add 1/2 cup of honey and whisk until blended. Add 1 teaspoon of vanilla extract and 1 teaspoon of lemon zest and whisk to combine. Pour dry mixture into wet mixture and stir until just combined. Fold in 1 1/2 cups of shredded carrots, then add 1/2 cup of raisins and 1/2 cup of chopped walnuts, and stir until combined. At this point, batter may be covered with plastic wrap and stored in refrigerator overnight, just allowed to come to room temperature before baking. Fill muffin cups to 1/4 inch from top and bake 20 to 25 minutes until tops are golden brown and just firm to the touch and a toothpick inserted into the center comes out clean. Remove from oven, let cool 5 minutes, then place on wire rack to cool completely. And now, maca. What is maca? It is a superfood plant. Find it in natural food stores that yields a slightly nutty flavor along with energizing vitamins and minerals. And here's another item from Let's Eat, and this is a big bowl of salsa and cheese over tortilla chips. Fast or Fancy is the headline. And this is a suggestion for Super Bowl, your Super Bowl party. And we're just getting to it here at the end of the month. Whether you want to dabble in the kitchen or craft the masterpiece shown here, we've got a plan for you. We turn to Kate McMillan, author of Fanfare, Game Day Recipes for Delicious Finger Foods, Drinks, and More, for tips on tackling two versions of a Super Bowl party must-have, nachos. And so we have this big bowl of nachos with some little tips written around the bowl. Cheese sauce is easier to make than you think and worth the effort. The velvety texture adds a satisfying contrast to the crunchy chips. It's also sprinkled with shrimp, and it says sautéed shrimp make your party spread extra special, and cooking them up takes only a few minutes. Score! And then finally, McMillan's Baked Tortilla Chips, and the recipe for that is at oprah.com/tortilla chips, are like cookies. Once you've had them straight from the oven, nothing quite compares. And of course, this big plate is surrounded with a small bowl that has lime wedges, another one that has guacamole in it, and then another that has chopped tomatoes and red onions. So let's see what she says about this, the fancy version. Toppings are the stars of the nacho game, but the best piles start with good chips, like the Heavenly Fresh version shown here. For ultimate sophistication, finish yours off with homemade cheese sauce and replace ground meat with succulent spiced shrimp. And here's the recipe for chili lime shrimp nachos. This makes 4 to 6 servings with a total time of 25 minutes. In a medium bowl, toss 1 pound of shrimp with 1 tablespoon of vegetable oil, 1.5 teaspoons of chili powder, and 1/4 teaspoon of kosher salt. In a small skillet over high heat, cook shrimp, stirring occasionally until bright pink, about 4 minutes. Stir in 1 tablespoon of lime juice and turn off the heat. Meanwhile, in a saucepan over medium heat, melt 2 tablespoons of unsalted butter. Add 2 tablespoons of flour and whisk constantly for 2 minutes. Slowly whisk in 2 cups of whole milk. When it starts to bubble, add 2.5 cups of shredded cheddar, a handful at a time, stirring constantly. Remove sauce from heat and season to taste with salt. Arrange tortilla chips in a shallow serving dish and pour sauce over chips. Top with shrimp, 1 can of black beans that have been drained and rinsed, 2 tomatoes chopped, 1/4 of a red onion diced, and 1/3 cup sliced jalapenos. Serve with sour cream, salsa, guacamole, and lime wedges. Now here's the fast version. Short on time or energy, open a bag of chips. Substitute 2.5 cups of store-bought rotisserie chicken chunks for the shrimp and use shredded cheese, 1 cup of cheddar, 1 cup of Monterey Jack, instead of the sauce. Broil the nachos until the cheese melts. Seats grain-free tortilla chips, $5. Melt in your mouth soft, salt-kissed Vestals. Have big fans on the O staff. And I'm guessing the pronunciation is seat. It's S-I-E-T-E. And go to sietefoods.com to find the stores for these chips. And then in the bottom, MVPs. Beer is the classic accompaniment for nachos, but wine fans will love seeing the Drops well-balanced canned vinos. $20 for 4, go to thedropwine.com. Non-drinkers will appreciate the touch of real fruit in Spindrift's sparkling waters. $36 for 24 of them. Go to spindriftfresh.com. We'll move from food to books now, and we will finish up the reading room for this month. And the first review we'll read is called Nickeled and Dimed. Prosperity is just out of reach in a dazzling debut novel. Copper and zinc combine to make brass, the stuff of earrings and trumpets and doorknobs. Similarly, Zenit Alu's lustrous Brass, and that's the name of the book, fuses two distinct plot lines, that of Elsie, a young pregnant waitress in love with Bashkim, an Albanian line cook, and the journey of her daughter, Lucida, 17 years later, to reconcile the past. The result is a tale alive with humor and gumption of the naughty, needy bond between a mother and daughter. Elsie and Bashkim's romance sparks when he tells her, "I swear to Allah, you are the most beautiful girl I have ever seen." It turns out to be insincere flattery. For starters, Bashkim is an atheist, and he has a wife he left behind in Albania to start anew in Waterbury, Connecticut, a factory town known as Brass City. The collapse of Elsie and Bashkim's relationship occurs in sections alternating with the present-day saga of Lucida, whom Elsie raised in Waterbury. Lucida is smart and tough. When we meet her, she gets a black eye from a gaggle of high school enemies. Fed up with her own bad luck and her mother's empty promises, she heads to Texas to find her father. In novels with multiple narrators, one often outshines the other. But Alu's dual protagonists are equally headstrong and witty, and their stories, separated by many years, parallel so gracefully that each chapter informs the one that comes after. Elsie's insomnia in one chapter is mirrored by Lucida's in the next. Each has fights with her boyfriend that echoes of the others. Waterbury's motto, inscribed in Latin on its city hall, is, "What is more lasting than brass?" Elsie, on the way to the gynecologist, finds the question ridiculous. "Everything lasts longer than brass," she says, "even mud, even the rubber on her sneakers." A reasonable theory, given the demise of the brass factories. Alu's first novel, on the other hand, marks the arrival of a writer whose work will stand the test of time. And the name of that book was Brass. And the next book we're going to read a review of is Everything Here is Beautiful. And the review is entitled Girl Interrupted. A first novel probes a soul's dark nights. Lucia Bach, the achingly troubled character at the heart of Myra T. Lee's Everything Here is Beautiful, is recently out of grad school and working at a newspaper until she begins to babble on about serpents and spies. Soon after, Lucia is found sitting atop a manhole cover, disoriented and singing. She's involuntarily committed to a hospital psych ward for a month. Her disorder, never officially diagnosed in the novel, haunts her for the rest of her life and terrifies all who care about her. But between descents into psychosis, Lucia's fierce passions for New York City, for her sister and their dying Chinese immigrant mother, for the men she loves, for her daughter, Esperanza, for the Peking duck and the spare rib she was raised on, are impossible for anyone, least of all the reader, to resist. When Lucia observes that Carinthia, quote, refers to that place in the ring where a bull feels strongest, safest, the place we're most comfortable, where we know who we are, end of quote, we totally get it. That Lucia so rarely experiences that sense of ease makes us feel her vulnerability all the more. Astonishingly, this is Lee's debut. There's not a false note to be found, and everywhere there are nuggets to savor. During a moment of contentment with Manny, her daughter's father, as the two lick cake frosting from their fingers and share a beer on a summer night, the Portuguese word saudade springs to Lucia's mind. She thinks, quote, "It's not exactly nostalgia. There's more of a longing in it for a feeling or way of life that may be impossible to recapture," end of quote. That longing is what sets in upon reaching the book's last pages. Why did it have to end? And now, when we turn the page, we have a review of the book, A More Beautiful and Terrible History. The title of the review is The Unvarnished Truth, A Scholar's Essential New Work, Maps the Pitted Road to Progress. Jean Theo Harris's A More Beautiful and Terrible History attempts to reclaim the civil rights narrative from the mythology that has enveloped it, reminding us how profoundly disruptive the fight for racial equality really is, and suggesting, quote, lessons for long-distance runners in the struggle for racial and social justice today, end of quote. Martin Luther King Jr. comes into particular focus, as does Rosa Parks, the subject of Theo Harris's previous book, recast here not as the gentle saint or our collective consciousness, but more accurately as an agitator and radical. Here we get the King, who had a 72% unfavorable rating among white Americans in a 1966 Gallup poll. The King who said, quote, the Negro's great stumbling block in his stride toward freedom is not the Ku Klux Klanner, but the white moderate, end of quote. The King who deemed the U.S. government, quote, the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, end of quote. Theo Harris's view of history is expansive, including women and young people without whom the movement would have been impossible, detailing forgotten stories of activists' fights to gain foothold in the ostensibly less racist North, and criticizing politicians, including Barack Obama, for oversimplifying complex figures. To call this slim volume a compelling attempt to reconcile fact and fable is to underestimate its ambition. What Theo Harris desires is nothing less than to show us, quote, who we are and how we got here, end of quote. Next we have a quote from A Kind of Miraculous Paradise, a true story about schizophrenia, by Sandra Allen. And here's the quote. It started out bad, like before, being injected with drugs, being thrown into seclusion a couple of times. Hell, one night they even handcuffed him to the bed. He yanked and jerked, but he couldn't break free. All he could move was his head. He could see that the guy in the bed next to him was shackled, too. Some orderlies came in and shot the guy full of something, and an hour later, Bob watched the rise and fall of the guy's chest stop altogether. In the morning, the orderlies came in and put a sheet over the corpse. As they wheeled it away, Bob could hear them laughing. And our final review is of the book, Tell Me More, Stories About the 12 Hardest Things I'm Learning to Say. The review is entitled Enough Said, A Celebrated Memoirist Experiments with the Art of Empathy. They're words most of us use all the time, the coinage of daily life. Yes, I know, I was wrong. The words that don't get in the way of what the other person is trying to communicate, that speak to our capacity to listen. In her new essay collection, Tell Me More, Stories About the 12 Hardest Things I'm Learning to Say, Kelly Corrigan shares her struggle to become fluent in these words, to be her highest and bravest self, to be more compassionate, to connect, to set boundaries, to know when to shut up. In I Know, Corrigan reflects on the last weeks in the life of her dying friend Liz, when all that was left to do was snuggle and cry. Quote, huddled in the foxhole, Liz and I had said it all. We were judgmental and bitchy together, desperate and existential too. End of quote. In I Was Wrong, she confesses her role in an epic family fight, concluding, quote, being wrong is not the same as being bad, end of quote. While the 12 essays sway with seriousness, there are plenty of winks and wisecracks. In No, Corrigan celebrates her mother, who, hashtag never, not once, indulged in her, quote, in the name of a hug, end of quote. Does it follow that raised by a no pro, Corrigan herself is a real ass kicker of a mom? Ha, she writes, then proceeds to chronicle all the time she's caved on absolutely nots issued to her children, giving in on everything from back-to-school sleepovers to watching the third season of The Bachelorette. If it's true that even women with loving partners sometimes feel they're going it alone when it comes to negotiating the terrain of intimacy, Corrigan's humane, luminous book reassures that while we may be on our own, we're on our own together. And that wraps up the reading room for February. So now let's wrap up some articles that we started last installment in a feature section of the magazine called Wake Up Call. We're sounding the alarm. You should sleep as if your life depended on it, because it does. Most owls are nocturnal, but if you don't enjoy being up all night, you're not alone. Feast your tired eyes on our comprehensive guide to sleep. Wondering why slumber is so elusive? We've got the answers. And this isn't really one long continuous article, but there are several sort of short articles grouped together. So we'll pick up with one that has a really cute graphic with it. So we're looking at a nightstand, and there's an alarm clock, and the digital numbers are spelling out, oh no. OH:NO, and there's a little plastic figurine of a sheep on the nightstand looking up at the clock. This particular article is called A Bitter Pill. For chronic insomniacs, sleep medication is not a magic bullet. About 4% of adults in the U.S. take a prescription sleeping pill in any given month, according to a 2013 report from the Centers for Disease Control. While pills can help regulate your sleep for short periods, say while you're in Europe for a week, they can impair your functioning the next day, sometimes in ways you don't even recognize. Michael Grandner, Ph.D., director of the Sleep and Health Research Program at the University of Arizona College of Medicine, says, quote, sleeping pills can basically make you lose consciousness, which will have side effects for the brain, end of quote. Many sleep meds slow brain activity by binding to the same neural receptors targeted by Valium, Xanax, and some types of anesthesia. Since the drugs suppress motor movement, they may leave you uncoordinated and accident-prone the next morning. Plus, studies indicate that long-term use may have lasting consequences for your memory and increase your risk of cognitive decline, which is why they're intended as a short-term solution only. Moreover, as Grandner points out, quote, over time the effects weaken and people become terrified of what will happen when the pills stop working altogether, which can make the sleeplessness even worse, end of quote. Chronic insomniacs, he says, would be better served by a program like cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, which gets to the root of the problem by attempting to reframe the thoughts, beliefs, and behaviors that keep someone awake. Another side effect-free strategy is spraying your pillow with lavender oil, says neurologist W. Chris Winter, MD. Studies have shown that the scent can encourage sleep. This really pays off when you're traveling, Winter says. Use the oil every night at home, then bring it on the road to mist your hotel pillow. You'll help trick your brain, which associates scents with memory, into thinking you're snuggled into your own bed. Our next little article is called In the Wee Small Hours, Why It's Always Darkest Before the Dawn. In his poem, Four in the Morning, Wisława Szymborska calls 4 a.m., quote, the hollow hour, blank, empty, the very pit of all other hours, end of quote. If that part of the night regularly finds you excruciatingly alert, you have sleep maintenance insomnia, as opposed to sleep onset insomnia suffered by those who have difficulty falling asleep. Your eyes are popping open because the sleep pressure that built up and eventually led you to fall asleep is now waning, says sleep researcher Michael Grandner, Ph.D. This pressure mostly dissipates within a couple of hours, leaving you more vulnerable to waking up for prolonged periods during the second half of the night. As sleep maintenance insomniacs know all too well, those pre-dawn hours are prime time for crafting catastrophic scenarios about nuclear winter or your 401k. That dread isn't just the loneliness of feeling like the only one in the world who's awake. It's also neurobiology. Grandner says, quote, "Our brain doesn't function in the middle of the night like it does during the day. The mature parts of our brain that help you maintain a perspective aren't awake in the middle of the night, so you blow things out of proportion. It's a bad thing to be awake while reason sleeps," end of quote. Middle-of-the-night wakers should pay special attention to their sleeping environment, as well as caffeine and alcohol consumption, says Grandner. If you're still waking too early, try these tips to find your way back to the land of nod. And there are three of them. The first one, get out of bed. For some people, Gardner says, quote, "the worst thing they can do is lie there trying to get back to sleep," end of quote. As that could train your brain to associate your bed with sleeplessness. Take this opportunity to rearrange your spice rack or open a book. Just make sure it's nothing too disturbing or suspenseful. And the second one, if you're anxious, write down what you're ruminating about. Whether it's a chore you forgot to do, change the furnace filter, or something more abstract, what will happen to the kids if you die? Getting your concerns out of your head and onto the pages helps free your mind so you can settle back down. And finally, when you feel sleepy, return to the bedroom. Stretch out, breathe deeply, and go to your happy place. Imagine yourself in any setting where you feel a sense of peace, whether it's a beloved vacation spot or under your favorite tree. And when we turn the page, we have a short article called Bedtime Snacks, What to Serve and What to Skip at Your Slumber Party. You know not to feast right before hitting the sack. 2 to 4 hours is the ideal gap between dinner and bedtime, says psychologist Michael Bruce, Ph.D. But an empty, rumbling tummy can also make it hard to nod off. Instead of going to bed hungry, Bruce recommends having a few bites. Here's help finding your snacking sweet spot. Here are things to skip. Turkey. Yes, turkey contains tryptophan, an amino acid, but not enough to make a noticeable difference. Bruce says, quote, "you'd probably have to eat around 8 or 9 pounds of it to get the drowsy effect," end of quote. Your post-Thanksgiving sleepiness is primarily induced by carbs. Here's another thing to skip, chocolate. The decadent favorite contains substances that may trigger production of dopamine, a feel-good neurotransmitter that promotes wakefulness. And finally, pizza. Craving a late-night slice? In one study published in Frontiers in Psychology, subjects reported that greasy, cheese-laden, and starchy foods frequently brought about disturbing or bizarre dreams. It may be that food sensitivities cue GI distress, leading to middle-of-the-night sleep disruptions and wacky nightmares. So here are the three things to eat. The first one, hummus. Chickpeas are rich in vitamin B6 and tryptophan, both of which can help your body make serotonin, which can then be converted into melatonin, the hormone that helps tell your brain it's bedtime. The next thing to eat is honey. The sweet stuff boasts compounds that reduce levels of orexin, another neurotransmitter that promotes wakefulness, says neurologist W. Chris Winter, MD, who suggests stirring a little honey into chamomile tea. Not only does chamomile have relaxation-promoting properties, but it warms you up. Then your temp cools down, mimicking the body's physiological signals as it prepares for sleep. Plus, he adds, a regular habit of tea before bed will eventually cue your brain that it's snooze time. And finally, black walnuts. These nuts are not only packed with melatonin, but they also help your body create more of the sleep-producing hormone, notes Winter. Now, here's our next article. You snooze, you win. A Pro's Best Tips for Napping by Laura Kinnery. Naps may not be the secret to world peace, but there's not a lot else they can't do. Beyond topping off your energy tank, a brief dalliance with unconsciousness can reduce stress, spark creativity, and even fire up your sex drive, says Sarah Mednick, PhD, an associate professor of psychology at the University of California, Riverside, who's been studying the relationship between napping and physical, emotional, and cognitive performance for 2 decades. We asked her for her best advice on how to do it right. And she has several suggestions here. And the first one, eliminate distractions. You don't have time to waste, so off with things that beep, buzz, ring, ding, and otherwise have the power to prematurely rouse you. Next tip, stretch out. Whatever accommodations are available to you, a recliner, a spot on the rug in the conference room, make sure you aren't contorted in a way that will cause you to wake up with a stiff neck or cramped legs. Mednick says, quote, if you're not comfortable, it won't be a quality nap, end of quote, and you'll be sore for the rest of the day. Next tip, time it right. Mednick says, quote, if you need a quick pick-me-up, a standard 20-minute power nap is perfect, end of quote. But if you have the time, a 60 to 90-minute snooze might be even better. It allows you to go through an entire sleep cycle, which can increase your creativity and thinking skills. Just avoid the red zone of 30 to 50 minutes. This is enough time to enter deep sleep, but not enough to cycle out of it, so you will likely wake up dazed and confused. Our next tip, nap before dark. You can steal a few winks whenever the opportunity presents itself, says Mednick. Make sure you're up before twilight, though, or you'll confuse your body into thinking it's nighttime. Mednick says, quote, the later you nap, the more deep sleep you'll get, which can rob you of the deep sleep you want to get at night, end of quote. And finally, don't force it. Mednick says, quote, if you're one of those people who just doesn't like to nap, then exercise is probably a better way for you to perk up, end of quote. And this next article is called, How to Help Your Body Help You Sleep. With a few physiological tricks, you can turn yourself into a lean, serene sleeping machine. And there are 3 of these tips. The first one, set a bedtime alarm. If you feel a sudden surge of energy about 30 minutes before bedtime, resist the urge to read another chapter or play just a few more minutes of Animal Crossing. You're perking up because your core temperature is beginning to drop as your body prepares for sleep. Michael Bruce, PhD, a clinical psychologist and diplomat of the American Board of Sleep Medicine, who advises patients to ignore that second wind and create a power down hour, says, quote, as your body cools, it's common to feel more energetic, end of quote. Set an alarm to go off 60 minutes before your bedtime, preferably on a clock. Your phone alarm is easier to ignore. Use the first 20 minutes to wrap up things, finish emails, find everyone's shoes, pack tomorrow's lunch. The next 20 minutes is for brushing your teeth and slathering on your potions and creams. The last 20, meditate or relax. Try the methods in maxing your relaxing, which we read in a previous installment, and I'll reread those in just a minute. Bruce says, quote, even TV is okay as long as it helps calm you down, end of quote. But remember, only 20 minutes. Now, here are the tips for maxing your relaxing. Make these body-centered calming techniques part of your bedtime routine. Progressive muscle relaxation. Lie down and let your body go loose. Now contract the muscles in your face. Hold for about 5 seconds, then release, feeling the tension flow out of your body. Move down to your neck and repeat. Travel all the way to your toes, contracting and releasing the muscle groups along the way. If you'd like a guided exercise, try the Pacifica app, which includes muscle relaxation and other routines to help you unwind. The second one is abdominal breathing. Take deep belly breaths, inhaling through the nose for 3 counts and out through the mouth for 6. And finally, yoga nidra. Also known as psychic sleep, this yogic practice requires nothing more strenuous than lying on your back. Zone out to the sessions in the Insight Timer app. Through guided meditation, during which you might focus on your breath, for example, you'll be lulled into a state of relaxed consciousness between waking and snoozing. So now we'll go back to the physiological tricks. The first one was set a bedtime alarm. That was the 60 minutes before your bedtime. And now the second one is skip the footy pajamas. That drop in your core body temperature may make you feel chilly, but you'll likely warm up again during the night, says neurologist W. Chris Winter, MD. So if you go to bed swathed in fleece and flannel, you could overheat and wake up. Wear lightweight PJs, or none at all, and instead rely on blankets that can easily be kicked off or pulled on. If you get hot, Bruce advises sticking 1 foot out of your sheets. He says, quote, "The smooth skin on your feet contains blood vessels that help release heat more quickly," end of quote. It's the perfect antidote to partner blanket wars. And then finally, the third tip, keep a sleep diary. Many women notice changes in their sleep quality throughout the month. Bruce says, quote, "Women can often predict how sleepy or alert they will be depending on their menstrual cycle," end of quote. The culprit, fluctuating hormones that can have an impact on your circadian rhythms. Women most often report feeling sluggish and tired a week before their period. Toward the end of it, the fatigue dissipates. To learn how your body responds to your cycle, keep a sleep diary for a couple of months. Track your period and record the time you wake up in the morning and how sleepy you feel during the day. If you tend to be more tired during certain times of the month, try moving your bedtime earlier for a week or so until you're feeling more chipper. Now, here's our last article about sleep. Vision Quest. You're finally getting the sleep you need, but what about your dreams? Laura Byrick reports on what's normal and what's not. I was in Scotland helping my stepfather tend his rhododendron garden when a crystal chandelier suddenly dropped out of the clear blue sky and crushed him, Wile E. Coyote style. I went to find help, but after walking for hours, I somehow ended up on Mount Everest. Feeling chilly, I looked down and saw I was wearing only a geometric print halter bikini. Odd. Not only because it was wildly inappropriate for mountaineering, but also because it looked exactly like a suit I'd resisted buying at Target the week before. Then I woke up. For as long as I can remember, I've had vivid dreams that make me feel like the protagonist of a fully immersive 8-hour Terry Gilliam movie every night. After comparing notes with my husband and friends and realizing that no one else had dreams like this, I started to worry that something was wrong with me. So I assembled a dream team of experts to find out what, if anything, dreams have to do with sleep quality. Here's what they said. Dreams can give the 411 on your REM. We dream during all stages of sleep, says Roz Dasgupta, MD, a professor and sleep physician at the Keck School of Medicine at USC. But the REM phase is where high-def adventures usually occur. One small study showed that people woken during REM reported that they'd been dreaming more than 70% of the time. Excessive nightmares, extended vivid dreams, or no dreams at all could signify a REM disorder. And that could be trouble. Dasgupta says, quote, "Quality REM sleep lets your brain consolidate memories and improves cognition," end of quote. Dreaming in REM also appears to be when the brain puts emotional events into perspective, recent research shows. Next, nightmares are normal to a point. The occasional bad dream, while upsetting, isn't a problem, but more than one nightmare per week could also point to past unresolved trauma or current stress, says Tore Nielsen, PhD, who runs the Dream and Nightmare Laboratory at the University of Montreal. In either case, you'd do well to take action. Talk to a therapist about what might be haunting you from your past. Come up with a plan to manage stress. Keep in mind, however, that another factor could be at work. Dasgupta notes that many drugs like antidepressants, some sleeping pills, and anti-malarial meds can cause vivid dreams and nightmares, as can withdrawal from cannabis. And finally, good dreams don't equal good sleep. If you regularly start dreaming the minute your head hits the pillow, you might be skipping the other stages of sleep and slipping immediately into REM, which could be a sign of a sleep disorder that requires a doctor's attention. Also, dreams needn't always be sweet. Even bizarre, creepy, confusing, or banal reveries can be helpful as your brain sifts through memories, reacts to scenarios, and works out the sometimes challenging puzzles that go along with being alive and human. Now let's move to an article in Feeling Good called Sick of Feeling Stiff? Unwind and unkink with these smooth moves. If you can hear your joints pop and creak when you move, that usually means the surrounding muscles, tendons, and ligaments are tight and underused. The right stretching exercises can help increase flexibility and, more important, mobility. This means you have full range of motion in multiple joints, and it feels great, not dangerous, to stretch in different directions. The benefits go way beyond your yoga class. Improving your range of motion reduces your chances of pulling a muscle when you do things like reach into the back seat or suddenly leap sideways to avoid a puddle, says Chris Dobrozelski, a certified personal trainer, owner of Monumental Results in San Diego, and spokesperson for the American Council on Exercises. Chris says, quote, "You want your body to be ready for the movements you encounter in daily life," end of quote. The following routine includes moves from Chris, as well as certified personal trainer Sarah Kush and Dane LaRoche, PhD, Associate Professor of Kinesiology at the University of New Hampshire. Try it before a workout or on its own and consider it a dose of WD-40 for your tight spots. So there are three of these. First, standing hip circles. Stand with your feet hip width apart. Then raise your right knee to your chest. Circle your knee out to the right, then bring it back to the center. Keep circling for 30 seconds, then repeat with the left knee. Second one, deep squat reach. Stand with your feet hip width apart and hands clasped in front of your chest. With your back flat, squat deeply so your bottom sinks lower than your knees. Reach up with your right hand, following the movement with your head. Bring your hand back to your chest and repeat with your left hand. Return to the start position. Repeat the sequence. Squat, reach right, reach left, stand for 30 seconds. Finally, rotate and reach. Start on your hands and knees. Lower your left elbow to the floor. Twist to the left and extend your right arm back behind your left elbow and left knee. Pause, then untwist to the right to bring your right hand up toward the ceiling, looking at that hand. Return to start. Repeat for 30 seconds, then switch sides. Now we have a sidebar, the other nut butter, and we have a coconut that's been split in half. So we're looking at the inside, snowy white inside. Everyone's going nuts for coconut butter, which is made from coconut that's been ground into a rich, creamy paste. Unlike peanut or almond butter, the cocoa stuff has a natural sweetness that makes it taste more like a treat than a health food. Yet it's a source of minerals like manganese, copper, and selenium, says Michelle Dudash, a registered dietitian, nutritionist in Carmel, Indiana. It also packs more fiber than almond butter. 2 grams in 1 tablespoon. The recommended daily amount is 25 to 30 grams for women, and most Americans don't come close. Coconut butter is high in saturated fat, 9.5 grams per tablespoon, but because of its silky smooth, drizzle-able, dippable texture, a little goes a long way. Dudash likes to pair it with tropical fruit such as papayas and bananas, or just enjoy it straight off the spoon. And now let's hear from what I know for sure at the end of the magazine from Oprah. What defines you? It's a big and important question indeed. The answer sets the course for everything that follows. What defines me determines how far I see myself growing and the boundaries I won't cross in order to get there. I will not do anything that willfully causes harm to another person. What defines me is answering the call to truth, capital T, in every moment. That's why small talk makes me jittery. It feels fake, like we're just pretending to have a conversation. I have such an aversion to it, I go numb inside. I can't look people in the eye because the whole time I'm thinking it's so beneath us to be talking about trivial things when our world is burning. I actively work to make sure everything I do, say, promote, or involve myself in comes from a place of resonance and appreciation. All my personal and business endeavors have to be in alignment with what's authentically me. I'm defined by my desire for comfort. I like comfortable people who share my values of kindness and treating others well. I notice how the people I hang out with speak to waiters and housekeepers. I like comfortable clothes, pajamas, or any facsimile thereof of my favorite thing to wear. And I like comfortable surroundings. I enjoy putting my feet up and curling up with a soft blanket at even the hint of a chill in the air. In 2010, the designer Rose Tarlow came to my home in Santa Barbara and said, "I've never seen such a disconnect. The house has nothing to do with you. It's like you created what you think a person of means should have." I had to rethink how I wished to express myself in my home. Rose said, "What physical thing around you would you least like to live without?" And books was my answer. And now I'm surrounded by books on every wall. Knowing what defines you brings you closer to being your most powerful. "Does this feel right?" is my guideline. Because I've learned for sure, if it doesn't feel right, at some point you'll find out it's not. Oprah. And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Susan Dellinger, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.